Okay, we're on page 27.
I am aware that I have left certain questions behind, and a little more material. With so much material, I'll go back and I'll explain it. So yesterday we did the first half of this middle paragraph. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, which provisionally we took to mean we as the nation. Hashem, our God, took us out of there with a mighty hand and stretched arm. Had not the Holy One blessed to be taking our fathers out, now we're not talking about the nation, we're talking about individuals. Then we are children of the children who would remain enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Now this sentence, if he had not taken our fathers out, we would have been, not remained, because I remained in Hebrew, we would have been enslaved to Pharaoh Egypt. Why should anybody think that? Every nation goes up and down, every empire eventually crumbles, the Americans think they're going to be here forever. But why should we think, thousands of years later, that if God had not taken us out, we would have remained slaves in Egypt? Maybe the author of God here has some source which indicates that God is committed to us being there forever, but in natural terms, there's no reason to think that that's true. And if you look carefully at the Hebrew, you will see that there's a shift in vocabulary, even though English translation doesn't register the shift, but there is a shift. The paragraph starts with the word avodim. Avodim means slaves.
Mishubadim.
Right. And in the second sentence, it says we would have been mishubadim. Now, there's no reason to change a word unless you change it in concept, unless there's some difference in the meaning. Mishubad in Hebrew means a lien. L-I-E-N, a lien. When you buy a house, typically you take a mortgage from the bank. And the bank thereby has a lien on your house. Now tell me, when you take a mortgage, buy the house, and the bank has a lien on the house, who owns the house?
Essentially the bank.
You own the house. You own the house, 100%, it's your house. If anybody damages the house, it pays you. If somebody slips some falls in your house, you are liable for the injuries. You own the house. If oil is found underneath, it's your oil. You own the house. However, there's a restriction on your use of the house. And there's only one restriction, really, and that is you can't sell it until you pay up the lien, until you pay up the mortgage. But you are the owner of the house, but it's not free and clear. You're not owning free and clear. The limit on your use of it. For the Haggadah to express itself with the word Mishubad here means something else. It doesn't mean you'll be slaves in Egypt, physically dominated by them and working for them. What it means is you may go free, but you'll never be free and clear. They will always have a lien on you. And for those of you who are Americans, you can see this right in front of your very eyes. Since 1865, there's been no slavery in the United States. But the black population is paying the fruits of slavery to this very day. They are still suffering the results of the slavery experience, slavery condition. They exist as freed slaves. But the title slave is not totally lost. The fact that they don't have a stable family structure, the fact that they don't have higher values, the fact that they don't have certain attitudes and habits that could lead to greater success, because they really had the restrictions taken off. So one could understand that God is saying, of course Egypt wouldn't have lasted forever. And of course you would have walked out. But you would have forever been freed Egyptian slaves. The impact of being slaves would have remained with you as part of your cultural identity. That didn't happen that way. God took us out. He took us out in a way in which we could break with that task. Indeed, in 50 days, we could stand at the Torah, at Sinai, and receive the Torah. So we could overcome that slavery experience. That's an easy way to explain what that sentence means. Now it goes on. Even if we were all men of wisdom, understanding, experience, and knowledge of the Torah, it would still be an obligation upon us to tell about, okay, we'll examine that in a second, the exodus from Egypt. The more one tells about the exodus, the more he's praised. Rav Bulman, if I remember correctly, who was the Mashgiach here, was a very considerable thinker, pointed out that on the surface anyway, this statement is a little peculiar. If you want to communicate something, other things being equal, you do it with as few words as possible. There's no point in just increasing words. You don't want to leave anything out, and you want to say enough to be understood. But to add words risks confusing the person who's listening, risks wearing out his patience, risks overloading his circuits. You want to be as concise as possible. When the Haggadah says, the more one tells, the more praiseworthy it is, it sounds like you should do more and more telling. Say more and more words. Just keep talking. Several women, that's an indication that the purpose of this exercise is not communication of information. That's not what's going on. If you're adding more and more words, you're not just communicating ideas or facts. Think of poetry. In poetry, you can have lots and lots of words, and they don't serve to communicate more facts. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a poem called Bells. At the end of each stanza, the word bells appears there about 15 times. The bells, 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 bells. Nobody reads it well. By the time you're halfway through the poem, you can hear them. You can hear them ringing. Not communicating more information by saying bells 15 times. You're creating an experience. Said Rav Ulman, and he's basing it on Sfas Emes, because Rav Ulman came from Gerach Hasidim. The speaking at the recital of the Haggadah, speaking at the Seder, is not essentially, not even primarily, a matter of communicating information. After all, what does the previous sentence say? Even if we're all men of wisdom, understanding, experience, and knowledge of the Torah, it would be a mitzvah to tell over the story. Well, if we really were men of wisdom, understanding, experience, and knowledge of the Torah, is it likely we're going to learn something new? Not likely. After all, imagine a person who's as ancient as I am. You know? I'm 63. I've been doing this for more than 40 years. Is it likely that I'm going to hear, or if I'm reading the Seder, say something? I'm going to say it. If I'm reading the Seder, it's unlikely I'm going to say something I don't know. Though, as those of you who have been with me, I know that sometimes in the middle of the year I do get a new idea. It does happen. So again, there's an indication that you're not communicating information here. Something else is going on. Now, the answer to the something else has a lot of ramifications, and I'll do it more completely when we have more information under the test. But I'll tell you what the woman said here, and again, based on what I said. It also says, L'tafer bit, which the essence right. Now, in Hebrew, when you have a verb followed by a noun, object of the verb, usually you say S. Or you can leave anything out, you put a lamed in. L'tafer bit means a personal involvement in the story. The personal involvement in the story. Not just reciting information. And it says that Moses went out of the palace by, and he saw the Jewish people by Yar Be'Sivlosam. It didn't mean that he saw their suffering, it means that he experienced their suffering. He empathized with their suffering. The phrase indicates a personal experience of what's going on. not just in a detached fashion, observing it and registering it and perhaps describing it. Zetzler, the Fulman, pointed out that in Hasidic sources, the word that we use for the holiday, Pesach, is broken into two words, Peh, Soch. The mouth recites. The mouth speaks.
Sach
means it's a word for speaking, like a siyach, a conversation. And he explained it as follows. In Egypt, there was not only physical slavery, there was an almost complete loss of Jewish identity. The Midrash says that when God was saving the Jews and punishing the Egyptians, the angels complained, "Why are you punishing this group and saving that group? They both worship idols, don't they?" And they complained to the angels to God. Chazal say that of the 50 gates of defilement, the Jewish people had already passed through 49. They were on the edge of spiritual annihilation. Now, speech is the faculty with which you express your identity. Nothing about you expresses your identity other than speech. There's no other way for a person to appreciate who you are and what you are without speech. Actions are ambiguous. Actions can be read in 13 dozen ways. That's what's wrong with our academic friends, the paleoanthropologists, people who try to do anthropology on the basis of archaeological remains and remains of proto-humans, supposedly from 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, and so forth and so on. You have no language from them. The oldest linguistic remains go back about 5,400 years. Before that, we have no linguistic remains. Without linguistic remains, you cannot understand why the person does what he does. You can't understand what it means to him. You can't understand what it expresses for him. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of those cave paintings in France, supposedly painted 30,000 years ago. They are enchanting. They're awesome. They're beautiful. The artistic merit of them is really outstanding. Why did they paint those paintings? Well, one theory is that they were preparing for the hunt. This was a way of working up magic to have a successful hunt. Another theory is that they were celebrating a successful hunt after the hunt. A third theory is that they were starving to death and they were painting pictures of these things to sort of assuage their hunger. A fourth theory is that they were artistically gifted and they enjoyed painting art, right? And you could use your imagination to dream up another dozen theories. There's no way to tell. Language expresses your identity. Narav Bulman said, these people, this group of people, the Jews in Egypt, to a considerable extent lost their Jewish identity. That means they lost Jewish speech. When the Exodus took place, there was a recovery of Jewish identity, which means there was a recovery of Jewish speech. Now, to Rav Bulman, imagine a person who goes blind, and he's blind for 10 years, and then he has an operation that restores his sight. What will he want to do? He will want to see. He will want to look and see. To see what? The cracks in the sidewalk, the sky, you know, the pavement, the trucks. Just to be able to see. Exercising that faculty, which he hasn't had for 10 years, will be a great joy to him. This, said Rav Bulman, is part of what's going on. Yes, the more you speak about the Exodus, the more praiseworthy it is, because you are exercising your faculty of Jewish speech. And whether you express new ideas or old ideas or say the same ideas over and over again, it makes absolutely no difference. You're talking. You're talking as a Jew because you recovered your identity as a Jew. And that's why the name of the holiday can be understood as Pesach, the speaking mouth, the mouth that speaks. And that's why it says, no matter how smart you are, no matter how much Torah you know, no matter how much you understand, it's a mitzvah to identify with the story that you tell, the Sefer Bereishis, that's right. And the more you do that, the more grateful it is. Yes. Beautiful, beautiful idea, which I heard from him myself.
And cave painting 30,000 years ago, would they existed in your mind before Abraham or Adam? Before Adam?
Well, not, that's what I said, according to their dating system, right? I'm not agreeing to that dating system. Yeah.
And isn't the Jewish idea that a person's actions are much more important than the words that he said? In general, somebody who's there are plenty of people who say all sorts of things that might associate themselves with good people, for example, and their actions are not good. And other people talk much less and do more good. Their identity and they're being defined by their actions. What play have is speech? I mean, speech is something obviously that you exercise, but what, how does it interact with?
Well, now you said two things, and the first thing you said I would agree with 100% is not relevant to what I was talking about, and the last thing you said doesn't follow from the first thing, and therefore there's a discontinuity there. I said nothing about what's more important, words or actions. I said nothing about them.
You said a person's identity is derived solely from his speech.
That had nothing to do with what's more important. That had nothing to do with what's more important. That's a separate issue altogether. What's more important, speech and actions? Okay, number one. Number two, speech is an action. When a person speaks, he's acting. It's an action. To divide speech from actions is very artificial. Number two. Number three, I was talking, of course I wasn't saying that when a person lies, he's expressing his essence. I didn't say that. When a person lies, he doesn't express his essence. Right? So, I'm saying, but I will say, I did say, and I will reiterate, that without speech, you cannot tell his essence. And from the actions that he performs, you certainly cannot tell his essence. Why does he give to everyone? Because he's generous? Because he needs people's support? There's a syndrome in children. They steal, they give presents to the other students in the class, so the other students will like them. Right? That's not generosity. That's fear and low self-image. Right? Or are you gathering their support so the later you can cheat them out of their houses? If you don't have speech, you don't know what the action expresses. You cannot tell a person's essence from his actions.
So that from his speech.
Oh, you can, but not if he lies, of course. But if he tells you what he means, what he wants, what his motivations are, then you can get evidence for what it is. But if he doesn't tell you, there's no way you can get it. Of course, if he lies, you won't know.
Like if a speech is a kind of is just one kind of action that the person can have, that you can derive information about him. why couldn't you derive that same information from his actions? If his actions aren't,
if the book has a cover and the book has papers, pages inside, why can't you get the same information from the cover that you get from the pages inside? Because the inside has information engraved in it, and the cover doesn't. The fact that it's a person, you know, why don't you get it right when he's sleeping? It's the person, and it's just the person's actions, so why don't you get it when he's sleeping? Because when he's sleeping, he's not expressing his essence. Not everything a person does expresses his essence. But speech expresses his essence, when he wants it to, of course. If he wants to hide his essence, he can do that as well. But without speaking to you to tell you about his essence, you'll never have a clue what his essence is. Apparently, Neanderthal man, they say, buried his dead. I actually read a paleoanthropologist who said this proves that he was religious, that he believed in God, he believed in a soul, an afterlife, and all the rest of that. Give me a break. Now, one sentence would do it. One sentence from them would do it. We dedicate this statue to the souls of our departed, who are living in the afterlife. We'd know right away what they believe. But the fact that they buried their dead tells you nothing. You can think of a dozen explanations for why they buried their dead. Only language can give you a clue as to a person or a community's essence. Without language, you can't have it. Don't misunderstand me. I don't say that before 5,500 years, they didn't have language. What I'm saying is we don't have any of their linguistic remains. We don't have any of their linguistic remains, so then we can't know what they were doing. Okay. Back to work. My Sibir Ebelezer. Five great Tanoim were sitting in Bnei Brak. Reclining, that's what it says actually. In Bnei Brak at the Seder. They discussed the Exodus, saying, stop reading the whole night until all that night, correct? Until their students came to them and said, our teachers, it is time for the morning Shema. Now this is very enigmatic. This is a very, I find this still challenging. I don't have any good explanation for part of it anyway. But let's just point out, some of the commentators point out that every one of these five did not descend from slaves in Egypt. Every one of them was not a descendant of slaves in Egypt. Because some of them are Levim and some of them come from converts. So part of the point here is, you might think, okay, it's a holiday and we're supposed to tell over the story, and it happened to my ancestors, so I feel a sense of detachment, you know. Okay, it happened to your ancestors, and then why you feel personally involved. But me, okay, I'm doing it. It's pro forma. No. They got so involved in it that the whole night went by, and they weren't even aware that the night went by, and the Talmidim had to come and tell them, this time, I preach my Shoshah. Okay, the mitzvah is all night. Terrific. Why didn't the Talmidim just come and tell them it's daybreak? Why did they tell them it's time for Krishma Shah? True! Daybreak is a good time to say Krishma. Very nice. But the masters here don't need the Talmidim to tell them that daybreak is a good time to say Krishma. So there are people who want to say nighttime is exile, daybreak is redemption. Those symbols are throughout the Tanakh, that's true. And that they were involved in working within the exile reality. And now it's time for a new reality. Krishma, serving the oneness of God, in response to the new reality of redemption. You could say that. What bothers me about that, I don't know how you'll take to this, but what bothers me about that is, in our tradition, that the disciples will reveal something to their masters that the masters don't know is not typical. It's so atypical that it's hard for me to think of a single example of such a thing. Judaism, traditional Judaism, is not a youth centered religion or culture. Nowhere is a person praised for being young. Many, many, many sources of people are praised for being old. No one says, he's proud of his youth, or even youthful looks. Elos ben Azariah, at a very young age, became the head of Sanhedrin, and a miracle took place, and he went white overnight. He was so grateful. He shouldn't look like a schnook, like a baby, being the head of Sanhedrin. His white hair, he looks like a person who's worthy of it. Why would the Talmidim be the ones to come to the rabbis and say that the time is over? I have no good explanation for that. To this day, it's been bothering me for decades. I've asked a lot of people. But at any rate, this is an example of how it was done. Now, for those of you who, when you learn some Talmud, you'll realize that there's a certain literary form for discussions in the Talmud. You have a Mishnah, then you have other sources, usually which are on a par with the Mishnah, other Tannaitic materials, you have verses from which the thing is derived, then you have disputes about how it should be understood, how it should be applied, and the end of the discussion is usually a practical case, a case where people actually carried it out. So you had the four questions, and you had the basic statement of what it is we have to do, and I have an example of how it was done. It more or less follows the standard Talmudic style. Okay, now comes a very indicative little paragraph. Oberos Manazaria. I am like a 70-year-old man. This is referring to what I told you about. He was really, I think, 17. He came to the Sanhedrin, and then he became white overnight. He says, I'm like a 70-year-old man. And I was not successful. Now, what it says literally is, in having the Exodus from Egypt dead at night. I wasn't successful in having it said at night. What it means is, I wasn't successful in bringing a proof to my position that it should be said at night. Until Ben Zoma explained that the verse tells us, in order to remember the day of your Exodus from the land of Egypt, all the days of your life. Now why is that phrase all the days of your life? Wouldn't the days of your life be enough? If it said the days of your life, would you think, oh, but not Mondays and Thursdays? Oh, but not the 16th of every month? If it said the days of your life, of course it would be every day of your life. There's no way to exclude any particular day. So why does it say all the days of your life? Ben Zoma said, the phrase the days of your life without the all would be the daytime period. The all would come to include even the nighttime period. So, says Rosman Isaiah, when I heard this instruction from Ben Zoma, I thought, oh, Baruch Hashem, I have a proof of my position. But my colleagues didn't give up. My colleagues didn't accept the proof. They said, it's true, the verse has to teach you something, but it teaches something else. The Chachamim Omrim, the Chachamim say, Yimei Chayecha, the days of your life without the all, refers to Olam Hazeh, this world. Kol, the extra all the days of your life, comes to include the era of the Messiah. Okay. Now, before we go into the details here, what are we talking about now? Well, what mitzvah are we talking about now?
Shema.
Shema. We're talking about the Shema. In particular, the third paragraph of the Shema, which talks about the Exodus from Egypt. Should you say that third paragraph only in the daytime? Should you say it at night also? Everyone says, you say it at night also? And then the Rambam says, no, you don't have to say it at night. What's it doing in the Haggadah? Who cares about that? We are in the middle of a once a year mitzvah. The mitzvah of retelling the Exodus in Egypt on the night of the 15th of Nisan. Why are we taking a Mishnah from Brachos discussing that mitzvah that occurs 365 days a year? And which indeed we did in Shul before we came home. The best answer here is that this is included to tell you what you're not doing. Yes, in Brachos it talks about a mitzvah to mention the Exodus, to mention it. Remember through speaking about it, mention it. 365 days a year. That's not what you're doing at the Seder. First of all, if that's what you were doing, you did it in Shul already. You don't have to do it again. But secondly, it's to set off what's going on in the Seder as an entirely different category. Now think back what I said in the name of Rav Bulma. We're not communicating information. We're not mentioning facts. We're telling a story in such a way that we can identify with the story. So this mission is here is to tell you, understand that the mitzvah of mentioning it on the one hand and reciting the Haggadah, the Seder, are two different performances. They have two different goals. Okay? Now, let's understand.
Why is it called Magid? Does a Magid mean to tell? Shouldn't be some word for experience?
That's a good question. Actually, you could ask it stronger. That's a very good question. The verb Magid isn't used. I know what the answer is, but in the actual description of the mitzvah, the saper bit, right? Doesn't say magid. And the reason magid is used because the verse in the Torah says the igaris levim. That's why magid is used. But you're asking, I don't know. So that's a good question. When we describe the mitzvah in the textual agada, we use the verb l'saper, in particular l'saper bit. The Torah's word is agid. And that's why it's called magid. I don't know. I have to think about it. It's a very good question. Very good question. I don't know. Okay, now let's understand. We have a verse for the kol, and the kol comes to add something. And there's a dispute about what the kol should add. Should the kol add nighttime, or should the kol add the time of the Messiah, the Messiah? I'm going to teach you how to learn now. So if the kol has to add something, it means that without the kol, I wouldn't have had it. Which means there's reason not to have it. There's reason not to have it. Only the call comes and says, no, let's add it in. But this thing you're adding in has to be secondary. It can't be as primary as the thing you had without the call, because otherwise it would be included without the call. It's got to be safe. There's going to be something against it. There's going to be some resistance. And the call says, I know, there's resistance, and it's not as primary as the other, but put it in anyway. Now the dispute between Ben Zalman, or Rosh Hashanah, took over his position, and versus the Chachamim, the dispute is which one is secondary but closer, and which one is secondary and further away. So that if you're going to use the call to include something, each one will say, there are two things that are secondary, but they're not equal, and the call will come to include the one that's closer, not the one that's further away. And the dispute will be which of the two secondary things, nighttime or the Messianic era, which of the two secondary things is closer to the primary, so that when you have the kol, it should include it. Right? That's the structure of the dispute here. Now let's see, what's the resistance to nighttime, and what's the resistance to the times of the Messiah? The resistance to nighttime is that when you're declaring God's unity, and in the text of the Shema, I'm sorry, go to the Exodus from Egypt, let's start again. When you are mentioning the Exodus from Egypt, if you are in a condition of exile yourself, it may be hard to appreciate the significance of the Exodus from Egypt. If you are in a position of freedom and possessing your own land, and the temple is built and the miracles are going on there all the time, that's one thing. But if you are subject to a repeat of exile, then it's not obvious that you can appreciate and really register what the Exodus from Egypt meant. We'll talk about that in more detail. Anyway, it's certainly not as much as the daytime. And therefore, it says it was in Isaiah, the kol comes to include even nighttime. One second. What do the Chachamim say? There's a resistance to saying, to mentioning the Exodus from Egypt at the times of the Messiah. Now this is based on an explicit verse. There's a verse in the prophet that says, when I take you back, ultimately, no longer will it be said the gods who took you out of Egypt, but it will be said the gods who took you from the lands of the north and brought you back. The verse actually says that the miracles and the effect of the ultimate redemption will be so much greater than the exodus from Egypt. The exodus of Egypt will certainly be less, it will pale, but in comparison to the ultimate redemption. So, the thought is, maybe that's the time when you shouldn't mention the exodus from Egypt. Maybe mentioning the exodus from Egypt would be in a certain way degrading, as if to say, you know, that's all you did. So, the rabbis say, I need an extra word, all, to tell me, even at that time when we will have experienced a much greater redemption, the early redemption still has to be mentioned. So you can understand why there's resistance to nighttime and why there's resistance to the times of the Messiah. And now there's a disagreement between Rosh Hashanah and the Chachamim where the resistance is greater. Okay, that's the structure of the Machlokes in this mission. Yeah.
So how suppose freedom out of exile produced from being obligated to do this place.
How is freedom out of exile? I'm not getting the question.
How did Torah mitzvahs produce freedom? And isn't it,
Okay, you must refer to what I said yesterday about freedom being engraved on the tablets or something.
I'm just talking about the redemption there.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, well, what is it that's going to take everyone to this redemption? And I presume it's mitzvahs.
Oh, I see. So you're basing it on your calculation. I couldn't see what I said. Well, the redemption could take place in a variety of different ways. One could be spectacular performance of mitzvos, and if that doesn't happen, God forbid, then it happen. Other ways, let me see if I can say something short and useful about this.
What sort of freedom are we talking about here?
Yes, I said redemption. I didn't say freedom. So redemption means you are now able to serve God fully, as against do you know where the official classical statement of Jewish Zionism is? This is worth knowing. Let me have the brown book. You say this twice a day. The official Jewish statement of Zionism. Gosh, only off of one page. That's pretty good. Now, in the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, when the reader repeats, and you come to Modim, the great paragraph in the Heligah article, you say the following: so may you continue to give us life and sustain us and gather our exiles to the courtyards of your sanctuary to observe your decrees and do your will and to serve you wholeheartedly. That's Zionism. Yes, gather our exiles to observe your decrees, to do your will and serve you wholeheartedly. That's Zionism. Right? So that's, I don't know whether you want to call that freedom or how we would exactly describe that freedom. It should be, but it's a subject that needs to be discussed. But that's what we're looking for, a redemption which will enable us to come back to the land of Israel, to keep his mitzvos and to serve him wholeheartedly. And if we perform mitzvos under difficult conditions, you invest yourself to do it under those conditions, so I'll enable you to do it under more favorable conditions. Okay. Now comes an introduction to the four sons. The four sons is a world. It's a world. I don't think I'll do it until tomorrow because it needs very special attention. But look at this paragraph. Blessed is the omnipresent. Okay. The word in Hebrew is makom. Makom means place. Capital T. Blessed is he. Blessed is the one given the Torah to his people Israel. Blessed is he. The Torah spoke about four sons. How many times do you have the word blessed in the couple of lines?
Four.
And he had four sons. Maybe there's a correspondence. Four blessed, four children. Of course, so you want to ask, what about the wicked son? Does the blessed go on the wicked son also? Okay, now let's see. The first one is makom. That's a funny thing. You call God place. Ha makom, the place. Chazal say, hu makomo shel olam ve'eino olam makomo. He is the place of the universe. The universe is not his place. Okay, I understand the second half. You don't locate God. Where is God? Gosh, the last time I checked, he was in Tiberias, but maybe he's moved to Tzfas. That's absurd. God doesn't have a place. A localized God. And even the temple in Jerusalem, which I suppose a simple-minded, naive 6-year-old could think is God's house, when Solomon built it and he went down on his knees and gave a long dedication, one of the things Solomon says is that the heavens and the heavens of the heavens cannot contain you. What then of this house that I have built? You don't have to be a clever 20 or 21st century theologian to know that God doesn't dwell in a house. Solomon who built it knew very well that God doesn't dwell in a house. The house is a place where God manifests his presence in a favored way. But he certainly doesn't have a particular location. So I understand, as I'll say, Olam Eino Makomo, that the world is not his place. That's of course quite correct. What we mean to say is that he is the place of the world. He doesn't have spatial dimensions. And say, you know where the world is? The world is under his left shoulder. I mean, it's ridiculous. What do you mean he's the place of the world? Now, in the deeper literature, the idea is something like this. What role does place have in the existence of the world? Anything you think of takes up space, right? Tables take up space. Molecules take up space. Smoke takes up space. What would happen if there were no space? Then there couldn't be any table. There couldn't be any molecule. There couldn't be any smoke. No mountains. No baseball games. They all take up space. Space makes everything else possible. Without space, none of it is possible. Now, abstractly, that's what we mean when we talk about place. We don't mean 25 miles due north of Beijing. The word place refers to making things possible. Hu Mekomo Shelo means that it is his will that makes the world possible. And as the Ramchal says in a number of Sforim, this happens in stages. He creates the world first by creating its possibility, the ground of its existence. And only afterwards does he realize that possibility, that potentiality, by making it into the items that we see. So it's he, now speaking in something which is absolutely crucial, but I'm not going to explain. By he, I mean his will. His will is the place of the world, means his will gives the possibility of everything's existence. Afterwards, it also gives the reality of their existence. But the word makom refers to the possibility of existence. Here, we're talking about God in the most fundamental description that we can imagine. That he makes everything else possible. Borahu. The word who in Hebrew, he in English, is third person. There's a gigantic difference between third person and second person reference, and it's characteristic of rabbinic literature throughout. What's the difference between you and he? Try to think in fundamental terms. What's the fundamental, most important difference between the word you and the word he?
One's close, one's remote.
Okay, say it more specifically. It's not just a question of relative distance.
Well, when I stay at thought, he's like right here, and when I
see,
he's not here.
That's not just close and far. It's not that one's 100 miles away, and the other's 5,000 miles away. At all, you can only be said to someone who's present. You can only refer to someone with the word you if he's present. He can be used to refer to someone who's absent. When you use third person reference to God, you're usually referring to God in a sense of removedness, distance, beyond real understanding, beyond experience, unrevealed, hidden. When you use Ato, you're referring to the way in which he communicates to us. than which he shows himself to us. Now when you start, blessed is God as the ground of the existence of the universe, that's definitely removed. And say, well, who? The little bit of a puzzle is to explain the next one. Blessed is he who gave the Torah to the Jewish people. And that's third person. Not Baruch Ato. Baruch Shenosan Torah Lemo Yisrael. Shenosan. Not Shenosato. But Nosan. That he gave. Rahu. Which indicates that even though he did reveal himself at Sinai, there was an element of removedness even in his revealing himself. There was an element of removedness even in his revealing himself. Now let's see. I told you something maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. We talked about this. A symptom of the idea that even in revealing himself, there was something removed. Something beyond in the revealing. All the people saw the voices. All the people saw the voices. Which from the point of view of our lives is an impossibility. You can't see voices. You hear voices. They had an experience that utterly transcends our experience of our world. And the point of that experience was to communicate to them that they were in touch with something that utterly transcends our world. They're interacting with something which can't be understood as an element in our world. Because in our world, you don't see voices. That doesn't happen. So even though they're experiencing it in a way which, so to speak, leaves them breathless. It leaves them without capacity to grasp, to conceptualize, to relate it, to compare it to anything. It's an experience utterly unlike any other experience that any human being has ever had. Even normal prophecy is not described that way. Whether it's Isaiah or Ezekiel or whatever you want. I don't think any other experience is described in those terms. They saw that which is usually heard. So even though there is a certain great revelation when God gave the Torah to Sinai, there was also a sense of transcendence. That's what I think justifies saying Baruch Hu again. Blessed is he. And I say it in the third person. Blessed is he who gave, not blessed are you that gave. Okay? Tomorrow we'll talk in the session before sunset. Thank you.